This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Welcome back, everybody, to the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson. The People Speak Show normally airs every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network. You can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the United States and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. That number again, 1-888-429-5471. Or you can join us live in the Government and Politics section of PAL Talk, the largest free chat program in the world, where we have a virtual radio show, the People Speak Radio Show, that anyone may join to participate in the show. This is an awesome show tonight. We're talking to a very special guest right here, Professor James Tracy, PhD. He's a professor of media history and analysis, political economy of communication at Florida Atlantic University. His recent research cast a doubtful eye on the false flag media events, such as the rise as ISIS clown school, and the widely examined Sandy Hook and Boston bombings false flag. A very warm welcome to the show, Professor Tracy, sir.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Fantastic to have you here. We'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour, but my first question to you, sir, is when did you begin to start questioning the mainstream media narratives about the major events that are happening?
Well, this has always been an interest of mine, looking at the news, critiquing it, trying to find out what the subtext of a story might be, and so looking beyond the main narrative that is presented to the public. Because if you look at, for example, coverage of foreign policy, coverage of domestic policies, government and corporate wrongdoing, the ways in which they seek to spin things, there's always something going on behind the scenes. And unfortunately, all too increasingly, journalists today, mainstream journalists, frequently they don't have the time, they might not have the experience. They may not have the training. They might not be seasoned enough to be able to actually penetrate these things. They might also be withheld by their editors, by the management of their news organizations, from probing these things more closely. And I think that actually now they have, to a certain degree, become accomplices in misinformation or disinformation. If we look at some of the events that I've analyzed somewhat closely, such as Sandy Hook or the Boston Marathon bombing, things such as ISIS and the foreign policy arena. So that's generally how I approach things. And as we proceed, as the media become more and more concentrated in terms of ownership, as they become increasingly corporatized, if you will, down to just a handful of entities owning or controlling much of what we see, what we hear, what we read, it's all the more important to be vigilant in that regard, not just as someone who might actually study it, but also as citizens.
I tend to think these days we don't have so much reporters anymore as we used to have in the past, in the 70s and the 80s. We don't have reporters who actually go out and investigate stories. What we do have in the news media are repeaters, are people that are just told to repeat what they're told for the mainstream media. Is that not true?
Well, in Europe and the UK, they're called presenters. And I think that that term is quite accurate, because like repeaters, they simply go on camera or they go on the mic, and they more or less provide pithy kind of bullet points of the day's headlines. And it's kind of a drive-by sort of thing. They don't really look into depth in particular stories. It is rather a matter of artifice, of what appears to look good in front of the camera or sound good, rather than actually digging deeper and finding out what's actually going on concerning a particular event, a particular issue, whatever it may be.
Do you think the reason that they don't look into this is they're told not to look into this? And has that created more of an opening for alternative media and independent people like yourself and maybe even James Fetzer and Dr. Kevin Barrett?
Well, recently, you know, if you are keeping up with the business press, those who are actually getting their news and information from the internet has now it's gone above and beyond those that are getting their news and information from television, from normal, you know, terrestrial broadcast and cable. And I think that's actually a good thing because people are exposed to a greater variety of reportage online. They can look at foreign sources. So if you want to actually find out what's going on with a significant story, you might not only look at, say, something like the New York Times or the Washington Post, but you get a real contrast with that type of coverage by looking at the likes of Russia Today or Iran's Press TV. You know, whether it be the conflict in Syria or what's going on in Ukraine, there are differing perspectives available online. We also have a burgeoning alternative media in the United States and abroad, and I think that that's been made possible by internet primarily, and new forms of technology that make it possible to do just what we're doing now, just what we're doing today, which would have been impossible 15 or 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago.
Absolutely. The internet has been a game changer for the major corporations in that anybody can get their message out nowadays. It's quite damaging to their official stories. Don't you believe that?
I think so, yes, to a certain degree. And I am afraid, I'm somewhat wary of the FCC regulations that were passed back in February, and I'm wondering whether or not, on the face of it, it's not a bad thing, net neutrality, at least in theory. But if you open up that door a little bit, there's always the possibility that there can be heightened types of state government regulation over, again, what kind of we're just doing here, what bloggers are doing. In many ways, bloggers are, to a certain degree, intervening in some ways, setting the agenda of the national news media. And I think that's a healthy thing. That's a good thing. And that's something that would not have been possible just a fairly short time ago. So all of these developments are good, but I think that they are in many ways increasingly making the traditional media somewhat outmoded, as you suggest, in terms of now they're still there, and I think they still are important and do provide helpful information with regard to various types of stories, events, but the alternative media in many cases, I think, do provide a perspective and hold some of those media in check and hold some of the powers that be, if you will, also in check vis-a-vis the mainstream outlets.
How is it that most Americans these days just do not understand that the United States funded and started and trained Al-Qaeda, just as the USA also started, funded, and trained ISIS and continues to do so? How do they not understand that?
Well, I think that the mainstream conventional media, the dinosaur media, whatever you wish to call them, the news media, are very good at presenting day-to-day coverage of what is going on. But when it comes to actually doing investigative work and providing context, deep historical context for events that are taking place on a day-to-day basis, they really drop the ball. And that's nothing new. That's been the case, I think, for decades. It takes historians and critical political scientists and sociologists to come along, economists as well, and actually provide a deeper sort of understanding of, say, for example, the U.S.'s involvement in the establishment of the Mujahideen and Al-Qaeda and now ISIS. That's something that I think that is left to, for better or worse, it is left to investigative journalists. It's left to independent authors and a handful of academics who actually do choose to, you know, to delve into these deep events a little bit more critically.
Do you think it's beyond the average Joe to understand that these are actually assets of the state? Do you think it's beyond the average person to fully realize it, that, oh, how could that be possible? The government would never do that. Do you think that's still the contention that most people generally have?
No, I don't, because if you look at polls of, say, those that question the JFK assassination, it's always well over 50%. It was actually probably at its highest in the early 1990s, depending on what poll you look at, following the release of the Oliver Stone film, JFK, of course, on Jim Garrison. And depending on which poll you look at concerning 9/11, especially among New Yorkers themselves, 40, 50, 60% or more of people question that event and question the involvement of the government in that event. But it's unorthodox, if not something that is taboo, to actually question these types of events in the mainstream media. So if you are a major prestigious journalist, then you're not going to actually question the dominant narratives, the official government sanctioned narratives concerning JFK or RFK or 9/11 or, you know, many, many others, Watergate, for example, or Sandy Hook or Boston, even though there is ample evidence to suggest that there is much more going on than major media are actually presenting to us concerning the events that I've mentioned. Not to mention MLK. Here's the most important African-American public figure in the 20th century, and a great many Americans are not aware of the fact that the government was intimately involved in his assassination, the U.S. government specifically. Now, I think that Americans are capable of comprehending that, but it's just not something that they get in the classroom. It's not something that the professor behind the lectern is concentrating on or delving into, and it's not something that the news media are looking at either. Conventional journalists or academics are not rewarded in terms of their career advancement to actually look at these types of events. But in my view, that's real history. That's something that we need a great, great deal of.
And people who control the history certainly control the outcomes of the future. Is that not true?
Yeah. This past summer, I taught a class, and we concentrate as a media criticism class, and it deals with media criticism, public opinion. And for the first time, I actually looked at a specific event. I've not done that before. I've kind of like looked at a variety of events or issues or phenomena or theories or, you know, kind of a broad swath of history. In this case, I chose to look at 9/11. And the first thing I did was I had students fill out a brief survey in terms of, because many of them, they were at the time probably about 7, 8, 9 years old. They were in second, third, fourth grade when 9/11 took place. And I asked them to recount where they were at the time, what their recollection of the event was, and what to their best understanding, how they understood that event. And almost all of them remember it as being a traumatic event, seeing their parents or their teachers crying. And so, you know, for a young child, a very impressionable child, that's a major event because they know something is wrong. They can't comprehend it or anything of the like. And almost all of them today, prior to taking the class and delving into things more closely and looking at various types of evidence, almost all of them essentially repeated the government narrative that Al-Qaeda was involved, and terrorists struck the buildings and the Pentagon and what have. More or less, that's the outline, with the exception of one student who'd taken a class with me previously. all 30 students repeated that. So this, to me, suggests the effectiveness of our educational institutions, of our media, news media, corporate news media institutions, in terms of furthering a particular narrative in order to defend and to bolster state power and a foreign policy in the Middle East and throughout the world that is killing people. So by the end of the class, I asked for students to, one of the essay exams for the final was asking for students to consider what they wrote down in their survey and what they've learned throughout the term. And what does this suggest about public opinion in the United States itself, where we are supposed to have a democracy, right? Where we're supposed to have a free press. If that, in fact, is the case, how could they have held this view, this narrative concerning the most important event in the past half century? And how could all the information that they considered be suppressed to the extent that it has been? It's out there, but it's not like put in any sort of coherent form by scholars or by journalists like it actually should be. So that, I think, it's something that evidenced, it's something that proved to a certain degree, I think in a very meaningful way to these students, the significance of alternative media, alternative perspectives, in a very concrete sort of way that they could apprehend, that they could really understand and appreciate.
Given the amount that you've researched into Sandy Hook and, for example, the Boston bombings, these two classic false flags, for example, do you believe there's enough evidence out there to say these were drills that were sold to the American people as actual terrorist events?
Almost certainly, yes. With regard to Boston, this was something that was visually demonstrated. There were two amateur, semi-amateur photographers that took photos, dozens of photos from above the actual, you know, what we are told as being this this bombing, whereby there were 260 people that were injured. There were not 260 people that were in the immediate vicinity of that particular, of the detonation of what I believe these were pyrotechnic devices, nor was the carnage there that one would actually see if these were authentic bombings. And so in those, a lot of those photographs are actually available online. There's also closed circuits video of the event and its aftermath. Normal emergency protocol, emergency response protocol and procedure was completely abandoned with regard to the Boston Marathon bombing, and as was the case with Sandy Hook. So we need to seriously question both of these events. Why is it that that sort of these types of protocols, these types of normal procedures were not actually implemented and carried through with as they would be if these were authentic events? So with regard to Sandy Hook, there is an abundance of information that has come forward that is available that actually causes me to have more questions than I think I had back in December of 2012 or January or February of 2013, when the major news media were giving me such a great deal of attention, you know, for at least a few weeks there. And yet the news media have moved on. They don't really want to discuss it, discuss Sandy Hook anymore at all, or Boston. To go back to my earlier observation, their reportage is very episodic, and they don't tend to come back and seriously interrogate what may have developed, what new evidence might be available to actually further question these types of events. It's just that if it's something that someone in power, someone in public office, in law enforcement, if they have actually stated that, well, this is what took place, that's good enough for the typical journalist and the editor and the given, you know, major news organization. Well, that's not enough. It wasn't enough in November 22nd of 1963 and thereafter. It wasn't enough December 14th of 2012 or April 15th of 2013 or any of these subsequent types of shootings, that are many of which are very questionable, not all of them, but a good many of them are. And unfortunately, again, with the mainstream media, they do not do their due diligence in terms of reportage like they should be doing. And that's why people are increasingly abandoning them and tuning into alternative media.
And we haven't even talked about the actors, the victim actors, the crisis actors yet. But I do remember at the Boston bombings, first photographs I saw of it, there were craft mercenaries hanging around the scene. There was quite a few of them who were photographed in full uniform. Do you remember those pictures at all?
Yes, and this is something that it's not surprising because there were drills that were taking place on April 15th of 2013 throughout the day, and as you may very well know, if you're going to carry out a false flag event, then you actually have drills going on so that if things are not presentable, then you can revert to the original narrative that, well, this was just something that we were doing as a drill. We saw this with 9/11. That was admittedly a very complex event. We saw that with the London 7/7 bombings back in 2005. We saw that with Sandy Hook. And we've seen that with Boston as well, not to mention various other events. But these are some of the key events where this is something that is, again, readily provable that there were drills that were taking place at the time in order for these constructed events, these events that are presented in the news media, to piggyback on. That is not to say that no one passed away with 9/11 or with the London 7/7 bombings. Those were serious events. But the more recent ones, in my view, they were largely artificial. With regard to Sandy Hook and with regard to Boston. That's my assessment. That was my assessment in the wake of when they took place in the immediate or semi-immediate aftermath of their having transpired, and even more so now. There's very little, if anything, that the defenders of the so-called official narratives of these events can produce that disprove the assertion that these things were constructed to manipulate in many ways public opinion towards other types of policies that the government sought to get through. With regard to Boston, it had to do with foreign policy to a significant degree, but also with regard to being able to implement martial law in a large metropolitan area. With Sandy Hook, it had to do with gun control, as well as a variety of mental health measures and protocols that are presently being carried out and implemented in public schools across the United States.
Yeah, I remember also at the Sandy Hook false flag, there was helicopter footage showing people walking around in circles over and over to get stock footage. Do you remember that at all? I mean, they made it so sloppy that people can see through this just by looking at the footage.
Well, people can see through it if they actually spend a few minutes, or more than a few minutes in some cases, to look at it more closely. But if you are just looking at this in kind of a drive-by way, if you're just walking through the living room and you're catching a few images and then going on, you might read the headlines, you might read the lead of a few stories in the newspaper or online. You see the images, the photographs of crying faces of the apparent family victims of the shooting, then that's good enough. And that will fool most of the people. And so you do have a small percentage of individuals who are actually doing what the journalists should be doing on YouTube. They're producing videos, or they're doing things on their blogs, or a combination of those things, really looking more closely at these events, doing real journalism, in my view. And they're the ones who are not fooled. But, there's another element of this as well we probably don't have the time to delve into. But the way in which it's right down to this kind of the dimensions wherein we perceive the world. More and more, it's mediated as through social media. It is, to a certain degree, via television. So we can't, it's difficult for us to actually fathom, to understand the deeper sort of detail of an event. And without that possibility, or without the understanding to be able to imagine how an event takes place and actually critically assess it and use, fairly simple logic — that's hardly anything that's taught anymore in most public schools today — but to simply apply those sorts of things that were one time fairly common tools, it's just done as much anymore. And I'm afraid that's also the case with journalists in many instances. I'm talking about conventional salaried journalists. And so these things are they become a part of our popular memory, of our collective memory. And they provide the basis for various types of public policies, or in some cases, foreign policy. If you look at something like 9/11 and you know, a ratcheted up police state. And that's why they need to be vigorously questioned at the time they take place and in the aftermath as well.
Now, we're going to take some phone calls and some questions from the audience after the first half hour. But my last question to you before we go to a break, sir, is your own personal journey has seen you get attacked by others in the education field because of what you're researching. Can you tell us what kind of attacks you've had personally and who has been behind them?
Well, again, I don't know how much time we have until break, or is there going to be a break at the bottom of the hour?
There's going to be a break in about a minute or so. If you could just summarize what's been happening to you, we can get back into that and after the second half hour. Sure.
Sure. Much of what has taken place at in the aftermath of Sandy Hook and Boston was at the hands of my own institution, at the hands of my own education, my employer. And there was a considerable amount of harassment. There was disciplinary actions that were taken, which were not warranted. And even my employer, the university, had to back down because they realized that there was no substance to these actions that that they were taking. And so I could go into greater detail, but that is the thumbnail sketch of what has taken place. Those things have been resolved more or less. You know, this it's kind of water underneath the bridge for the past couple of years. They were resolved in fall of 2013. But at the time, it was something that was rather unnerving for me.
Well, you're listening to the People Who Speak radio show coming to you live across America and across the world. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson, and we'll be back with our guest tonight very shortly after this short message break.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on BBS Radio.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak, every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to the People Who Speak radio show on the BBSRadio.com network, coming to you live across America and across the world in real time. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson, and we're back with our guest tonight. He's a false flag analyst and serious political researcher and a writer contributor to TruthFrequencyRadio.com, where he's interviewed a lot of people. And, of course, check out his other website, MemoryHoleBlog.com, where he writes and publishes articles. Welcome back there, Professor Tracy, sir.
Happy to be back. Thank you.
Fantastic. We have a question on the line. We've got somebody who's called in. We have Joe Magnitz on the line with a question. Are you there, Joe?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, sir.
Should I start?
Hello?
The question, can you hear me?
I can hear you, yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, Mr. Tracy or Professor Tracy, when I hear you talking, I hear the same blah, blah, blah as everybody else that gets on a chance to get on a microphone. Instead of going to the real problem, and that's the corruption of our political system by these Zionistic so-called Americans that are born in America but loyal to Israel, why don't you cover that part? That's the only thing that keeps these wars going, is the complete compliance and corruption of our political system, our financial system, our news media, and every other system that we have in America, completely and totally corrupted by these Zionistic freaks that are sending us, our soldiers, into war to protect them. For what reason? Because these poor people in Gaza are living on land that God gave to them. Why don't you address that instead of worrying about ISIS? As long as our politicians are allowed to be bribed by these damn Zionistic freaks, nothing will ever change. They own us. When you vote, you only vote for who they choose that we can vote for that will next sell the American people and the and America to these Zionistic freaks. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, I think that we've been talking about what you're suggesting for the first half hour, and I have discussed ISIS, and I've also related...
No. You're diverting. Talk about the corruption of our political system, where no matter who you vote for, it's still the same empty-headed puppet of the Zionists. No matter what you see on television, it's still through the corruption of news media by the Zionists. Address that, because that's the problem. The Zionists aren't suffering. The people they corrupt aren't suffering. Everybody else is suffering due to the corruption, and they're both in bed with each other, screwing us all, and they're laughing all the way to the bank.
Okay, Joe, I think
I'm tired of seeing American soldiers being sent off by our corrupted politicians to kill and to die and wasting our taxes so that these Zionists can have a piece of cropland that God gave them. Why don't you...
That's a very interesting question, Joe. Can you let the professor answer? Go ahead, professor, if you'd like to respond to that.
I think that his frustration is it's well taken. There's no doubt that Israel has a tremendous influence in the United States with the likes of AIPAC. The fact that you have the prime minister come over here and our Congress being as as fawning as they are to a foreign leader suggests a great deal. So, and I have as well. It was kind of difficult for me to respond because I think that he's fairly dead set in his perspective. But one of the things that I did point out in my analyses and discussion of ISIS is that there is the site intelligence group that is run by an individual who has fairly close ties to Israel. Whose father was worked for Israeli intelligence, was executed in Iraq back in the late 1960s, and it's perhaps telling that this site intelligence group, which is a private entity, is able to issue press releases on these beheadings and on other activities of ISIS without being questioned at all. And this is simply taken as gospel, as something that is true, is genuine, is real by much of our news media. In fact, they also had a hand in the development of the narrative on the Chattanooga shooting back in July. They were the ones that released the alleged blog of the shooter himself. Right. And you know, here we have, we spend tens of billions of dollars per year on intelligence in the United States. And you're telling me that we have to revert to, we have to rely on this site intelligence group, which is a modest private organization, operation. It doesn't make any sense at all. And I'm not sure who exactly is pulling the strings, who is making the editorial decisions at our, in our, in our news media. But this is something that is ripe for criticism. You say the same thing about the Syrian, the Human Rights Observatory. For the past few years, ever since we've sent terrorists into Syria to dismantle the Assad regime, you have a handful of entities, including the Syrian Observatory on Human Rights. Right, this consists of a couple of individuals. They're actually based in the UK. Charlie Skelton did a great expose on this for The Guardian back in 2012, I believe July of 2012. And here is this organization. They are anti-Assad. They are for the destabilization of his regime. And they are being quoted left and right by Western news media as having valid information concerning what is taking place there on the front lines in that in that tragic conflict and the dismantling of that country. Why is it that these organizations have such clout? I would say certainly with regard to site intelligence, once again, it's something where there are very clear ties to Israel.
And of course, I'm not shy to name that person who's putting these videos out. It's Rita Katz, a Mossad agent that you're talking about, that runs site intelligence, that gets all the bin Laden videos before anyone else, gets all the ISIS videos before anyone else, gets all the Al-Qaeda videos, and they seem to be the progumation. They seem to be the point that they're distributing all these videos. Is that not true?
Exactly, yeah, and that's something that I've sought to point out in these articles. And I think that it's more complex than what the caller is suggesting, in that everything must be – everything the Jews are to blame for everything. I think that Israel as a state is being used by the West, is being used by the Anglo-American Empire, if you will, as a tool in that region. They are strategically located and extremely powerful militarily. And they are, since the late 1940s, they have been used for the purposes of manipulating that region that has really not been the same since the end of World War I.
Right. We have a question from Buzzy Krongard in Langley, Virginia. Professor Tracy, broadly speaking, who owns the major media and major radio and TV U.S. media? Broadly speaking.
Well, it's a handful of corporations that own or influence about 90 to 95% of what we see, what we hear, what we read. And Ben Bagdikian is probably many of your listeners know, wrote The Media Monopoly back in 1981. And the first edition of that book came out. And at that time, there were 50 corporations that controlled the much of print and broadcast, a majority of it. And by the time that he released, I believe, the seventh edition of that book in 2005, the number of companies was reduced down to a handful, down to five or six. So it had gone down from 50 to five or six companies that actually control much of what we see, much of what we hear, much of what we read. Many of these individuals, the boards of directors of these companies, share associations, interlocking relationships with other companies in the financial sector, in insurance and the like. They also may be members of the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations. So they're closely associated. It's a very small world at the top. And they see the world in a particular way. And I think that they use the news media in order to shape the consciousness, the perspectives, the views of the broader public in the best way they can. I think of the news media and the media more broadly as being our continuing education or miseducation system in the United States specifically. Because, you know, again, you do have a small segment of the population that are looking at alternative media, that are better informed, but many, unfortunately, are not. And they believe that they can look at a copy of the New York Times or the Washington Post or a regional paper or a local paper and get a fairly good idea of what is going on if they read a newspaper at all. And unfortunately, that's not the case. If you look at all of the cable channels that are available today on television or the equivalent, or you know, all of the websites on the internet, but look at cable specifically, that type of model, there appears to be a great deal of competition because you might have hundreds of cable channels, right? But most of those cable channels are owned by a handful of companies. So there is the illusion of competition. And when in actuality, the ownership is really, really very tight. With regard to the internet, anyone can put up a WordPress site, for example. But you first of all have to produce good content in order to get a stream of traffic, and that takes a great deal of time. So the technical component of it is really fairly simplistic. But actually producing good work, whether it's good videos, whether it's broadcast journalism or the equivalent, or print journalism or commentary, that's something that takes time, and it takes a certain degree of expertise, I think, to be able to write proficiently like that. And the bulk of the web traffic today is going to the same kind of dinosaur media that dominate cable and broadcast. So the likes of, you know, CBS, ABC, NBC, ESPN, unfortunately, that's the case. You still have fairly some salient alternative media, but a lot of the attention and a lot of the news and information that is generated is being distributed by those larger channels.
Right,
so that's,
right.
I mean, one could you know, extend that critique a little bit further. I mentioned the CFR and, you know, some of these elite organizations, but I think that they do have an influence in the news media, in the agenda generally, but also I would argue probably a bit more intimately with some of these deep events, these complex, these kind of constructed events. The fact that there are so many of these mass shootings that are taking place today, and the ways in which those are presented to the public in an unquestioning sort of way by by these major media.
We have another audience question. This one was texted into us from a guy called Hadding from a public toilet in Birmingham, UK. Your question is, does Professor James Tracy see any reason to doubt the official Holocaust narrative?
Well, there are a couple of colleagues of mine, in particular Jim Fetzer, and he just wrote a book, in fact, on this, along with a colleague of his, and it's called, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. I have had him on. We have discussed the book. He's delved into this, very, very closely, this particular historical phenomenon. I think it's something that there should be the opportunity to be able to question any type of event, regardless of how tragic it is, regardless of its dimensions in that regard. This should be made available by this should be open to journalists, academic institutions, scholars, academics themselves. And the fact that there are laws against that in some countries is very unfortunate.
So in essence, your answer is the truth fears no questioning.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And I suppose that my response to that question might not be satisfactory. And I think that probably the individual who's posing the question would have a right to assert that. But it's a very sensitive topic. It's something that's it's something that is a you know, there have been people that have lost their jobs. In fact, Nick Collistrom, who was a very you know, well-established scholar in the UK, because of the fact that he came out questioning that event. He thought that he was fairly safe, and that was not the case at all. So it's something also, someone earlier, of course, brought up Israel. There is no doubt that there is a great deal of power, public relations and propaganda power that country and its defenders wield here in the United States and in Europe. When you look at entities such as AIPAC and the ADL, and they will go ahead and smear an individual, and it's very difficult to be able to actually defend oneself once something like that has been done.
Yes, these organizations very routinely crush people in the media who speak out about these certain topics that are taboo on the media. We have another question from Langley, Virginia. It seems like the phones are running hot from Langley today to the station. From Buzzy Krongard, his follow-up question is, Professor, have you studied Operation Mockingbird, and do you think it is alive and well today?
Now, one of the individuals that I had the opportunity of interviewing in 2014 was Robert David Steele, who's since this individual is calling from Langley and using that that pseudonym, perhaps it is Buzzy. So he'll appreciate that this is a former CIA case officer who is fairly well known and a published author and an expert. And we were talking about Mockingbird, about Carl Bernstein's very famous essay, The CIA and the Media, published back in 1977. There are a handful of other good treatments of this phenomenon. Deborah Davis's book on the Grahams and the Catherine Graham specifically in the Washington Post, which is a bastion of CIA activity in the news media. Anyway, Robert David Steele's remark briefly is that it's worse now than ever. It's worse than it was in 1977. When the Church Committee was carrying on its investigation, and you know, the Pike Committee and so forth. It's even worse today because it's nothing that was actually addressed at that time, right? George H.W. Bush came out and said, "Okay, there are not going to be any formal relationships." Well, the relationships still existed, and I think that it's only accelerated. They've proliferated by this point. But it's a very good point, and it's a very good question, and there's no doubt that the intelligence community is rooted in the news media, and they have been since the 1940s and the establishment of the OSS, because journalists are gatherers of information. In foreign locales, in domestic locales. And so they're plugged into what's going on. They have an excuse. They have a profession for actually gathering information and questioning people and so forth. So they're the go-to, they are the go-to profession, the go-to people for obtaining information, for having assets. If you were running an intelligence agency, whether it's a public one that is theoretically overseen by the government or whether it's private, you'd want to have those connections with the news media. And that's one thing. But I think the more pressing question is, to what degree do those agents, do those assets drive influence and the overall news itself? And to what degree do they color our vision of the world, if you will, and right. And influence our opinion and our understandings of the events of the day and broader types of historical trends?
We have a question from Jane Bond in California. Professor Tracy, what's your personal opinion about 9/11? Could 19 Muslim bumbling hijackers really have done the entire operation, in your opinion?
Well, I would encourage I would encourage Jane to go back and listen to the first half hour of the program, if it's available on MP3 or something along those lines. If it can be listened to again, I talked about how I had my had a recent class and we discussed 9/11, and that's just something that we focused on as the basis for considering how public opinion is shaped, the influence of the mass media on our perspectives, I guess, you know, in this country, but also abroad. I think it depends on. I would say no. I don't accept the official narrative. That's the brief response to that. There's just too much countervailing information to actually accept the conclusions of the 9/11 Commission, of Philip Zelikow's commission and kind of orchestration of that narrative ex post facto. So that would be my brief response.
But in your personal opinion, do you believe it was Mossad, or was it Larry Silverstein, Dick Cheney, or all of the above? Maybe a conglomeration of PNAC and the Project for the New American Century, and of course the Council for Foreign Relations. Do you believe they're all involved?
I would say that it was no single agent or entity or organization. That it was something that was coordinated along a continuum, a variety of interested parties. But to leave it on the doorstep of one entity, one nation, one intelligence agency would, I think, be an oversimplification.
Absolutely.
There's no way that you could actually carry something like that off without there being a coordination between the military, between intelligence, and also, I think, probably between private actors. We take for granted now the extent to which I think intelligence activities have been privatized. And think about just the parties that benefited. You know, cui bono is the major question here. Who ultimately benefited from 9/11? It wasn't only the military, the defense, the weapons manufacturers, but it was the creation of a police state and new forms of technology that are being used to take away our freedoms. So they're just all sorts of parties that ultimately benefited from that. Now, were they involved in the event immediately? Not necessarily, but I think that this was something that was orchestrated to a large degree to fulfill a number of agendas. Part of it having to do with foreign policy and incursions abroad and committing declaring war whole hog on an entire region of the planet and the Middle East, and also to take away our civil liberties and our rights here at home. So I think it was unfortunately, it's been quite effective in both those regards, and it's been terribly destructive for our country.
Final question for you, sir. We're just about to finish and wrap up, but we're going to have to get you again. I've still got a lot more questions for you. But final question, do you support the stop funding of Israel by United States taxpayers?
I would say that that funding would need, at the very least, be seriously scaled back. And that there really does need to be an effort to hold that nation to account in terms of its various human rights abuses against the Palestinians and other peoples in the region, considering the fact that here you have a country with an awesome military might as well as nuclear weapons capability. And so there would have to be certain types of, I think, conditions at the very least for there to be continued funding. And it would take a leader in the United States, take someone with a great deal of gumption to put America first, second, and third.
Absolutely. Fantastic answer. And thank you so much for the interview today, sir. God bless you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the People Speak radio show with special guest Professor James Tracy, PhD. I'd like to thank him and remind all the listeners to visit his articles on memoryholeblog.com. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Professor. Join us coming up soon on the People Speak show when I talk with Graham McQueen, Webster Tarpley, and Ken O'Keefe. Stay tuned for these big interviews coming soon. Big thanks go out to the producers, Mike and Donald, and to all my friends throughout the world, online and wherever, to all the guys who give me such support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune into my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel. But for me for now, take care. Until next time, bye for now.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood